This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, I can't lie, listeners. This is a hard day, the day after Election Day. It feels like the hounds of hell have been unleashed on our country again. I'm hurting. My 20-year-old granddaughter, who voted in her first presidential election, texted me this morning. She said, "What the hell happened?" And then, "Is the world going to die?" I know many of us are wondering the same. But life goes on, and we need to find a way to go on. So I want to read to you some words from a post that the author Rebecca Solnit wrote today on Facebook. We spoke with her many years ago about her book, A Paradise Built in Hell. It's about the solidarity people create in the face of overwhelming disaster. The election we just had pitted hatred and division against solidarity. Here are Solnit's wise words to us today to remind us that solidarity is not only not dead, it is vital that we hold fast to it in our lives. Quote, "They want you to feel powerless and to surrender and to let them trample everything, and you are not going to let them. You are not giving up, and neither am I. The fact that we cannot save everything does not mean we cannot save anything, and everything we can save is worth saving. You may need to grieve or scream or take time off, but you have a role no matter what, and right now good friends and good principles are worth gathering in. Remember what you love. Remember what loves you. Remember in this tide of hate what love is. The pain you feel is because of what you love. The Wobblies used to say, don't mourn, organize, but you can do both at once, and you don't have to organize right away in this moment of furious mourning. You can be heartbroken or furious, or both at once. You can scream in your car or on a cliff. You can also get up tomorrow and water the flower pots and call someone who's upset and check your equipment for going forward. A lot of us are going to come under direct attack, and a lot of us are going to resist by building solidarity and sanctuary. Gather up your resources, the metaphysical ones that are heart and soul and care, as well as the practical ones. There is no alternative to persevering, and that does not require you to feel good. You can keep walking whether it's sunny or raining. Take care of yourself and remember that taking care of something else is an important part of taking care of yourself, because you are interwoven with the 10 trillion things in this single garment of destiny that has been stained and torn but is still being woven and mended and washed. That was Rebecca Solnit today on Facebook. But to go forward, we need also to think about how we got here. So we begin today's program by replaying our 2017 interview with historian Timothy Snyder about his book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. But because we must continue to live and find joy if we are to persevere, later in the show we'll talk with Olivia Lang about their luminous book, The Garden Against Time, In Search of a Common Paradise. It's about how they repaired the small world of one ruined garden, and about how we can, perhaps, repair the larger world as well. After Trump's first election in 2017, historian Timothy Snyder wrote his book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. The book was intended as a kind of vaccine to inoculate us against acquiescing to authoritarianism. Let's listen again to my conversation with Timothy Snyder, and let's take his lessons to heart. Well, Timothy Snyder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Very glad to be with you.
Your book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, begins with the idea that history does not repeat, but it does instruct. Talk about the difference between those two things.
So I start with the notion of repetition because I'm trying to open up American minds to how history might be useful. When we compare the U.S. to darker periods of European history, or when we even invoke European history to talk about the U.S., the reflexive American response is to say, is it exactly like that? And of course, it's never exactly like that. The United States in 2017 is obviously not exactly like, for example, Germany in 1933. But that, as I see it, is a kind of laziness on our part. We've ceased to think historically about most things, and we kind of flatter ourselves by saying, well, I've just tested to see whether it's exactly the same. It's not exactly the same, therefore we can move on. That's the way the American mind processes, or rather doesn't process, history. What I'm trying to say is that history instructs. That is, if you know a whole lot of different examples, you can find patterns that will be present today, or you can recognize a historical moment in which some elements are similar, or you can identify with someone who experienced something which is a bit like your own predicament, perhaps more intense, and who left behind a useful record of what he or she went through and what he or she can now recommend. So I'm trying to say that history instructs in the sense that if we go back and broaden our imaginations, we'll be able to understand our own moment better and to act in it better. Now, there's also a darker version of history instructs, which is that it's quite clear that some people who are in power today in the United States and elsewhere in the world are instructed by the history of the 1930s in a way that I would like to for us not to be instructed, right? So even if you choose to imagine that history doesn't matter at all, there are always people out there who are nostalgic for the darker periods of history, and they might well be in power. In fact, at the moment, they are.
Timothy Snyder, you've mentioned the idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that our country is somehow unique and different from all others. What's the problem with that idea?
The problem with exceptionalism is that it's like wearing a pair of blinders. You know, everybody's unique, right? I mean, every country is unique. The only thing, you know, the thing about exceptionalism is that it's universal. Everything is exceptional. And once you recognize that, then you can be a little bit calmer about your own nation. The problem with exceptionalism in moments like this is that putting those blinders on can mean that you don't see things that are coming at you from the sides or from the back, threats or history coming back. If you say that, for example, American democracy is going to be American democracy because it's always been American democracy, then you're denying yourself of the sense of urgency that you need. If you say that it can't happen here, you're making it happen here. We're at a moment where one's actions, the actions of American citizens, are more important than they would ordinarily be. Gestures, words, everyday decisions that might not have mattered 3 years ago and hopefully won't matter so much 3 years from now matter an awful lot. So if you say it can't happen here, you're choosing not to do anything. You're making it more likely that it will happen here. If you say American institutions are so wonderful, they will save us automatically, you're undermining those very institutions, because the whole point is those institutions are under attack, and therefore they need help from American citizens. So exceptionalism is a bit of a trap. I mean, it's important to be proud of one's country. Be a patriot is lesson 19 in the book. But if you want one's country to be its best, especially at moments like this, you have to act on your own.
Another kind of exception you talk about in the book is that laid out by the Nazi legal theorist Carl Schmitt. What does Schmitt's example teach us?
His big idea was that politics starts from enemies and friends, so that's the only meaningful political distinction, and that political sovereignty means that you can declare a state of exception. So he has a book called Political Theology, and the first sentence of that book is, the sovereign is the one who can declare a state of exception. So this is important as a kind of politics, because what he's saying is all the laws, all the rules, all the customs, all the traditions, all the practices, those aren't real. All that's real at the end of the day is the power to discard all of that, the power to say, from now on, we're in a different world where there are going to be new rules. And of course, the thing that Schmidt is going to have in mind after 1933 is the moment when Hitler was able to have a state of exception declared. Hitler comes to power in February 1933, but he's still the chancellor of a republic. Then there's a terrorist attack, and Hitler declares a state of emergency, a state of exception, or he has it declared. The president formally declares it. And after that, you basically have a Nazi regime. So the notion that something happens and therefore you can cast all the rules aside, that's part of the template of building a modern tyrannical regime. It's a good example of going back to your first question, of how history instructs. We can choose not to worry about states of exception, but every aspiring tyrant in the world, including Steve Bannon, including Donald Trump, know this template. They know that if there's something like a terrorist attack, they can use that as an excuse to declare a state of exception.
Yes, and in fact, we've already seen that in the United States with the, in some ways, destruction of habeas corpus and the rule of law after 9/11.
So, and I mean, now's a good time to think about 9/11, because 9/11 is a good example of how Americans failed on a couple of important fronts that are very relevant now. We failed to be serious truth seekers about the relationship, or rather the non-relationship, between Iraq, the country that we invaded, and the terrorist attacks of 2001. We, meaning the broader public, we, meaning a great deal of the press, we, meaning the political class, the parts that were in power and some of the parts that weren't. That's not a mistake we can afford to make again. We're now being confronted with a full-on assault on the idea of truth as such, led by the White House, which has become a kind of mendacity industrial complex. If we're not serious about the everyday truth, if we don't support the good investigative journalists working at the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Guardian or other places, we're going to be sunk. The other test of 9/11 is, as you say, the test of the state of exception. We failed then too. We didn't take seriously enough our own freedoms. We got a bit lucky, I put it this way, in that our very bad leadership at the time was not as bad as the leadership we have today. So if you look back at our reactions to 9/11, we have to realize if there's something like that again, God forbid, or any kind of horrible, shocking event on the territory of the U.S., it's quite likely that the current leadership will reach for more than the Bush-Cheney team did in 2001, that they will reach for something like a state of exception, that they will ask us to turn over our rights. And so it's very exception that we recognize that this is not only a possibility that it could happen, but that this is a whole pattern of politics. In the whole 20th century, we've had terrorism for the whole 20th century. It was actually the age of terror. The first age of terror was the early 20th century. We've had terrorism for the whole 20th century, and modern authoritarians, usually right-wing, but not always. Stalin did this as well. Modern authoritarians seize on moments of fear of terrorism in order to create authoritarian regimes. That is a pattern of politics. We have to see it as a pattern and then recognize if there's a terrorist attack, our emotions are part of a pattern and we have to break it. We can't let our fear and grief prevent us from defending our own rights if there's a terrorist attack here.
Yes, and another thing that tyrants use, as you point out in the book, Timothy Snyder, and On Tyranny, is that they use our very institutions in order to come to power themselves, and that we put a trust in those institutions that may be a little bit out of bounds from what they really deserve. So what do we need to do to make sure that our institutions are in fact robust?
The most basic institution which we rely upon is the institution of the regular election. And it's important to notice that in some of the cases of tyranny that we try to remember, like, for example, Hitler's rise to power, there was an election in the story. The National Socialist Party won the November 1932 elections in Germany, which was one of the reasons why Hitler could come to power. Not the only reason, but it's in the mix. And if we look at the authoritarian regimes around the world today, the majority of them also have an election somewhere in the story. So the way that modern tyrants consolidate regimes has to do with coming to power through elections and then dismantling the system around the elections. Often the elections themselves continue, as they did, in fact, under Nazi Germany, but they are increasingly ritualized and meaningless. So the mistake is to think just because we had an election, the person who won the election cares about a democratic system. It happens over and over again that people like Mr. Trump, who have in fact declared their opposition to the rule of law and their indifference to democratic norms, are elected. And then those people tend to bump up against the walls of the system and to try to change it, which is also true of Mr. Trump. Now, what this means more broadly is that this thing that we call democracy is not just a matter of waiting for every 2 years, every 4 years for there to be an election, and then maybe taking part in it. It means that the thing that we call democracy is part of a larger system, a larger constitutional system, a larger rule of law system, which depends not only on the written rules, but also on how we choose to comport ourselves in the meantime. So in lesson two of the book, which is Defend Institutions, I have in mind the constitutional institutions, the judiciary, the legislature. I also have in mind major national institutions like trade unions, for example, labor unions, newspapers. But it's also very important to realize that our professional institutions, whether we're journalists or lawyers or civil servants or doctors, are very important. Regimes can only change when people forget about professional ethics. So now is a time for people to take professional ethics particularly seriously. Likewise, non-governmental organizations, whether they're directly political or not, form a kind of layer between the government and the individual, preventing that situation where the government faces off against the lone individual, which is romantic, but the lonely individual is always going to lose. Freedom is not just freedom of association. Freedom happens because of association. If we spend time with people who have similar political or non-political interests, if we do things with them, we affirm ourselves, we affirm them, and we create a layer of politics between the rulers and ourselves. So institutions in all of those senses are very important.
I kept on thinking as I was reading your book that haven't we seen a slow motion attack on government institutions and democracy through the last several decades? I mean, we can talk about Citizens United and the capture of the state by corporate interests. We can talk about voter suppression efforts by the Republicans that have been extremely successful. We can talk about the hacking of electronic voting machines, no matter who does them, whether it comes from domestic or international agents. You know, we find ourselves at a time when our own democratic institutions have already been eroded. Can we regain the ground and how?
Yeah, and that's a wonderful question. So to start off, I want to say something which is going to sound a little simple and naive, which is that I think democracy is a good idea. I'm not cynical about democracy. I think democratic elections produce better outcomes than non-democratic elections or non-democratic systems, not only in terms of freedom, but also in terms of prosperity. I think that were the American system more democratic, we would also get better outcomes. You mentioned Citizens United, which, you know, ensconces the completely ridiculous principle that money should, you know, essentially count for more votes. As everyone knows, it does. You mentioned voter suppression, which is a problem. The Electoral College is also an undemocratic institution because it means that a voter in one state can have a vote that counts for dozens of times as much as a voter in another state. Gerrymandering, no matter who does it, is also undemocratic. If you're in Ohio, for example, today, and you're a Democrat, your vote counts for roughly half as much as vote of a Republican. So for all these reasons, all of those examples, the money, the Electoral College, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, move us away from a one-person, one-vote system. So democracy in America would be a good thing. It's an aspiration. It's something that we have to get to. Now, a second point that you make that I want to expand on is the attack on government. We can disagree about how much government we need, but we do actually need a government. We do actually have to have politics. And one thing which the American right has fallen into is the habit of saying that whatever goes wrong, it's the fault of the government, even if it's the fault of international capitalism, even if it's the fault of the weather, whatever it might be, it turns out that it's fundamentally the government's fault. That's not what government is. Government is there precisely because economics is unpredictable, or for that matter, because the weather is unpredictable, the world is unpredictable, and government is that set of rules and that set of protections which allow us to live side by side and hopefully be free and prosper all the same. So it makes no sense. We can disagree about exactly what government should do, but attacking government and getting into the mental habit of blaming government for everything is ultimately toxic for us and will drive us down. Now, when it comes to the foreign intervention, I mean, this is something which is being investigated, but it is, I think, rather important if you're a citizen of the United States and you believe not just in democracy, but just in the sovereignty of your country, to take this issue very seriously indeed. For me, this book is a kind of homecoming. What I really do is I really work on Eastern Europe. I work on the darker chapters of European history. I know Russian, I know Ukrainian, I know Polish. Until the last few months, I spent much more time in those languages, German too, French, than I did in English. And the notion that Russia would try to intervene and undo democracy is completely familiar to me because that's been underway for the last 5 years. This goes back to exceptionalism. We only notice it when it happens to us, and we think, oh, how is that possible? Maybe that's some kind of crazy conspiracy. Maybe it's just the left-wing media. No, that has been Russia's consistent and very sober and very effective foreign policy for the last half decade. So let's just get used to the fact that it happens in the world, and it very likely happened to us. And I mean, for me, it's not just a question of democracy working. It's a question of the basic honor of the republic. Is it okay if foreign powers decide who rules us? I think it's not. But ultimately, my answer to your question is that I agree. We have to get much better. And the 20 lessons that I try to lay out in the book are meant to be things that not only will help us get through the moment of crisis we're in, but will also train us to become better citizens. Because, of course, you know, the solution is not to go back to 2016. The solution is to have a much healthier civil society. That's ultimately what the book is about.
Yes, and I want to get onto that. But I also want to note that it's probably a good idea, if we want to stand to the high moral ground, that we also should not interfere in other people's elections, which I think has been also part of U.S. foreign policy. However, the first rule is do not obey in advance. And you refer to the policy of Gleichschaltung in Germany. So tell us about the rule and explain what happened in Germany.
So, yeah, rule number one, do not obey in advance, is the most important of all. It's the most important of all because it arises from one of the things that we historians think we understand about 1933 and Nazi Germany, and which political scientists and other scholars believe they understand about other authoritarian regime changes. Namely, at the beginning, the people who aspire to do away with republics and create authoritarian regimes need the consent of the people. They don't need it necessarily in outward forms such as marches or even voting, but they need consent in the sense of people looking away, people drifting along with the new ideas, people not objecting, people looking away as institutions begin to be attacked or as minorities begin to be attacked. That's a very special form of consent. Now, the thing that we also know from sociology and psychology is that that behavior, the obeying in advance, is normal. And in most situations, it's appropriate. So we're conducting a phone interview. We both know you're going to ask questions. I'm going to answer questions. That's completely normal. It's normal that when you walk into a new room or into a party or into a meeting, you adjust to the basic rules of the situation. Being a citizen, though, means recognizing that you're in a special moment where that kind of adjustment, that kind of implicit or subconscious self-adjustment to the new situation is actually helping a new regime with new ideas to come to power. So being a citizen means recognizing that, and knowing the history that this is how republics die can help us to recognize that. So it's also number one for another reason, which is that if you can't get number one, the don't obey in advance, then lessons 2 through 20 become irrelevant. If you do obey in advance, if you say, oh, this is normal, it's not a big deal, this is not a major change, I'm going to wait till my friends do something, I'm going to wait till the newspapers are sure. If you do that, then you change yourself psychologically. Once you've taken the first step to say, this is normal, it's extremely hard, in fact, virtually impossible to undo that first step. And then politically, the timing is incredibly important. If you miss the opportunity to not obey in advance, then you use the first weeks and months to tell yourself it's normal. And by then, even if you do persuade yourself that you should do something, it's much harder to act. The first few weeks and months, the first year basically, where we are now, is crucial. If you decide, I'm just going to wait and see, if you decide, this is normal, then what you end up doing is changing yourself internally in a way that you probably never would have expected because you become a much less free person. And you also blow the chance of making a difference at a crucial historical moment. So that's don't obey in advance.
Yes, and then there's another one which I think follows on what you just said, and that is be wary of paramilitaries, because we know that there was resistance, maybe not enough, but there was resistance to the Nazis. In Holland, there was the February general strike that was against the Nazi occupation, but it got fiercely put down. So I wonder if you could talk about this and How do we harden ourselves against the terror from the right?
Yeah, so let me start a slightly different way, which is why paramilitaries are risky in general. I'll come back to left and right, but there's a basic principle here, which is that if you're in a rule of law state, there have to be organs of government whose job it is to enforce the law. They're not going to be perfect. You know, they can be subject to abuse and so on and so forth. But the government has a monopoly on legal force. That's something that we take for granted. You know, if vigilantes appeared on your street, you would think that it's unusual. I mean, I guess depending on where you live in America, but in general, you would think that would be unusual. The way that paramilitaries operate, therefore, is at a very fundamental level. If people get used to the idea that the state doesn't monopolize violence, that there are other institutions out there that also have the right to use violence, then the government is no longer the government. The government blurs, the government wavers, the government becomes the kind of thing that we're not accustomed to. That's one of the elements of Hitler's rise to power. It's also, for that matter, one of the elements of the Bolshevik Revolution and other authoritarian regime changes. You have a paramilitary. You keep it out on the streets, use it to resist the government, use it to beat up your enemies, use it to intimidate the population. And then, and this is the German case, once you have an election, you keep those guys going, and they continue to change the political atmosphere. And then you use them for special tasks, which are maybe illegal. But then what was once illegal starts to become normal over time. In Germany, the classic example is the concentration camp. So that's why, in general, one has to be concerned about paramilitaries. In the U.S. now, where the vast majority of paramilitary activity is on the right, I mean, on various kinds of right, the same principle holds. If one is, for example, in Portland, Oregon, one should be very concerned about the possibility of paramilitaries taking part or supplanting the police in preserving, quote-unquote, order in public demonstrations. If one is a citizen of the United States, one should be very concerned that at Mr. Trump's rallies, he used his private security detail very much the same way that fascists did in the 1920s and 1930s, and then that Mr. Trump expressed a desire to keep his private security detail going when he was president of the United States. That's a basic clash with how the rule of law is supposed to work. If one considers the recent firing of FBI Director James Comey, notice how it was carried out. Mr. Trump sent the head of his private security detail, Mr. Schiller, to go personally fire Mr. Comey. So these are all symptoms of people, either from the paramilitary side or from the executive branch of the United States government, trying to permeate, trying to break through, trying to weaken this basic line, which says if there has to be a threat of violence, it has to be legal. Paramilitaries are a threat to that basic idea, and so they're one fundamental threat to the kind of state that we take for granted.
We talked in the beginning about the politics of inevitability, the idea that democracy is inevitable. You also talk about the politics of eternity, and you contrast it to that. Tell us what that means.
So with the politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity, I'm really just trying to get across the idea that history is real and history matters, that history is out there for us to learn from, but we have to acknowledge it, and we have to be a little humble, and we have to learn. I think history is extremely empowering if we let it be, and the purpose of the book is to crystallize some lessons from difficult periods of history into a form that most Americans could follow most of the time. But history can only be useful to us if we're open to history. The politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity are kind of historical masquerades. They're ways that we claim to be paying attention to the past, but they're actually ways of being unhistorical. So with the politics of inevitability, what I have in mind is the idea, which is very widespread in this country, unfortunately, that history somehow ended in 1989 when communism came to an end. You know, that human nature means capitalism, capitalism means democracy. Therefore, whatever the facts seem to be, however many exceptions keep racking up, that therefore we can just count on things moving in a certain direction. Everything's going to be fine. And that also means we don't have to really remember the concepts or the details about the past, because all that stuff in the past is just there to move us towards this inevitable story about the future. The great irony about that is that the reason that we think history came to an end is because communism came to an end, but communism came to an end because its story about the future is wrong. Our story about the future is wrong, too. All stories about the future are wrong, and they disarm you, and they make you vulnerable. And then when a shock comes, you don't really know what to say because you've already said I know what the future holds, but what if you're wrong? And you've already said, well, we don't really need to know about the past, but when shocks come, you really, really do need to know about the past. So one of these shocks was the election of November of 2016. And I could see and feel, and this is why I wrote about it, how people were slipping from that notion of inevitability to something else, which I call the politics of eternity. What the politics of eternity is the idea that things just keep happening, that history is a kind of cycle. And this is a very dangerous idea because it means you go from being sure that the future is going to be good to being sure that the future is going to be bad, that the same bad things just come around again and again, that the nation is virtuous, but it's vulnerable to outside attacks, and therefore you just have to be ready for outside attacks. So this is very much the politics of Mr. Trump, Mr. Bannon, the Make America Great Again, you know, where the again is really about the 1930s, and trying to get back to a sense of the rest of the world as a threat. Of refugees is a threat, migrants is a threat, world economics is a threat, everything is a threat. Whether or not our leaders actually believe in this, what it does is it creates a kind of politics where everything is of the moment. So if we are constantly under all kinds of threat, then how can we possibly imagine that we could have reforms that would might make things better? All you can do is panic constantly, and then you know your panic will prevent you from noticing that perhaps your health care was just taken away or your Medicaid was just taken away. And how can you complain about those things when there's a constant state of emergency, when the evildoers, the bad hombres, are always on the doorstep? So when I wrote the book, I was concerned about us shifting from one style of thinking about the future and past, which is wrong, to another style of thinking about future and past, which is also wrong and more dangerous. And what I was trying to do is to insert history between them, to say, look, we're at a historical moment of great significance. If we pause and think for a second and realize what the bad possibilities are, but also what the good actions are, what the historical limits are, but also what the historical possibilities are, if we see this moment and therefore see our own responsibility in this moment and for this moment, there's an awful lot that we can actually do if we choose to. So we have to shake out of the inevitability, shake out of the eternity, and take responsibility. And the book is basically a manual of that. It's a set of examples of people who did take responsibility, and it shows what they have learned and what they can teach us.
Historian Timothy Snyder talking with Writer's Voice in 2017. Snyder is professor of history at Yale University. He's the author of several previous books, including Bloodlands and Black Earth. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the midst of the pandemic of 2020, my guest Olivia Lang restored a singular garden of unusual plants from a state of ruin to magnificence. They did so by paying close attention to what the plants themselves were telling them. As Lang writes on their website, the work brought to light a crucial question for our age: who gets to live in paradise, and how can we share it while there's still time? Their best-selling book, Garden Against Time, seeks to answer that question. In addition to their own garden, the gardens Lang consider range from the imagined, like John Milton's Garden of Eden and Paradise Lost, to real historical gardens, from those built from the profits of slavery to those created by utopian communities. The Garden Against Time was a finalist for the 2024 Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction and the 2024 Wainwright Prize for Nature Writing. Olivia Lang, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, it is very nice to be here.
The Garden Against Time, what a wonderful and deeply soul-satisfying book. It interweaves the story of your own reclamation of a famous garden when you bought a house and property, the house and property where the garden was, along with a contemplation of the garden as the expression of a vision of paradise or utopia, and the complicated story behind that. It's such a rich and thought-provoking book.
I'm very pleased you liked it. Thank you.
So first, tell us about your own garden. It was originally constructed by a famous gardener, Mark Rumery. Is that how you pronounce his name?
That's exactly right, yeah. So Mark was a well-known landscape gardener, landscape architect. He was the apprentice to Lanning Roper, the famous American landscape gardener. And he made many gardens for other people, many gardens for extremely wealthy, grand estates, rich individuals. But this is the only garden he ever made for himself. So it's not enormous. It's a third of an acre, but it's a garden of great intimacy and charm, and it is the garden very clearly of a total plantaholic. It is crammed full of interesting and unusual species.
And what was the condition of the garden when you found it?
It was very interesting because Mark had died 10 years before and it had been in other people's hands and they weren't gardeners. And in some ways, they had let it be sort of reclaimed by nature. So it was covered in ivy. There were a lot of weeds. It was hard sometimes to see what was there. And there were a lot of dead plants. But that is a consequence of their other decision, which is that they didn't want to take anything out. They were scared. They didn't know what was precious and what wasn't. So basically, everything that had survived was intact. There hadn't been that sort of, well, we'll just put in a whole new garden. So I was very lucky in a way. I came into it and it looked like the secret garden. It was overgrown, but I could see from the very first walk round in the beginning of January that there were unusual things there. There was a Daphne Beulah, which was covered in pink flowers, which exudes the most extraordinary smell. There was witch hazel with its sort of strange yellow lemon peel flowers, also extremely fragrant. So I knew it was a serious, very beautiful garden, but I could also see it was a lot of work.
Yes, an enormous amount of work. You know, this is the time when my garden is still producing, but I see that it is also time to begin to put it to bed, so to speak. So it was really wonderful to read, you know, just how you thought about the plants themselves. You know, the eternal, I think you actually say this in the book, you know, the internal push and pull between collaboration with nature and competition with nature, you know, imposing your own vision versus allowing what is there to flourish the way it is. So talk a little bit about your process through that before we get into some of the larger issues and questions and histories that are in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a constant tension for the gardener, and especially the ecologically minded gardener, which I think more of us are these days. So on the one hand, I think for myself, I want to produce something that looks visually beautiful, that is a visual spectacle. And on the other hand, I'm increasingly interested in allowing things to die back, in letting the garden be a habitat, in letting leaves lie on the ground. You know, it's autumn now, so I'm very much in this debate with myself about exactly where to draw that line. And it's interesting, as an artist, as a writer, you have total creative dominance over your medium. I'm used to being able to produce something that is exactly aesthetically what I want. And a garden isn't like that. Things fail. You have difficult weather. It rains for months and then you get a drought and a heat wave. And the asters that you planted so lovingly all die. So it sometimes can feel like a wrestling match. And other times there are just the most joyous surprises. And with this restoration project, it took 3 years. And for the first year, I did very little. Really, I just took out the obvious weeds. I cleared away what was definitely dead. And I just watched. I waited to see what was there. And there were many surprises and many delights, as well as the horrifying discovery that we had honey fungus, for example. So it was an interesting period. And there were times where I've really exerted more dominance on trying to make the garden look the way I want, and times where I've really tried to step back and see what happens and what wants to grow where.
Yes, and take honey fungus as an example. I had actually never heard of it. I'm not sure if it's something we have here in the U.S., but...
Oh, you do have it in the U.S.
I'm going to go look for it. And when you first discovered it, it seemed like such a dire thing. People told you were going to have to take everything out. You know, you're going to have to just eradicate, sterilize, whatever. But you ended up not having to do that. What happened with the honey fungus? You know, the plant that it had so terribly infected. Is it still around?
It's still around. It's mostly dead now. And now I've taken some branches out, but it is still there. And it's been interesting seeing how long trees can stand up against it. But I discovered something really interesting the other day, which is the amount of dead trees that there should be in a healthy wood, that dead wood is actually an important component of an ecological system. It's a habitat for an enormous amount of creatures, a lot of invertebrates. And so in some ways, the sort of pearl clutching that I and the RHS and many gardeners went into around the idea of, oh God, there's honey fungus, something's going to die in my garden, was perhaps a little bit, you know, overwrought. So what I'm trying to do now is to enjoy the presence of something that provides a very different habitat and to think around it aesthetically. How can I make that work with the rest of the garden? What can I grow up it that will survive? So again, it's been an interesting challenge and definitely not the tragedy that I initially thought it was.
Your title is The Garden Against Time, Olivia Lang, and you write in the early pages that the garden is a time capsule as well as a portal out of time. What do you mean by that?
What I really meant is there's a way in which this book is quite a traditional book. It's a look at gardens through the ages. It's a look at different historical gardens and different ways that people have thought about the garden. The garden against the backdrop of time, let's say. On the other hand, the garden is a space in which we enter a totally different experience of time to our sort of 24/7 news cycles, our constant productivity, our never switching off. The garden is a space where you fall into a sort of perpetual present. And I think that's something that all gardens intuitively know. We go out, we might have a great list of things we want to achieve in 2 hours, but after about 10 minutes, we've entered a totally different sort of relationship with time. We're swimming inside it. And I was really fascinated by that. I felt that that was a very important thing to inculcate in our century, in our sort of frantic, desperate century, to have a space in which we're not on clock time.
Yes, that is so familiar. You know, I go and I think, oh, I've got 15 minutes. I'll just do this or that. 4 hours later.
Picking seeds out of your hair.
Yeah, it is. And it is so healing as well, as a matter of fact.
And I do think that that's the thing that gardeners really love, is that the experience of time, as much as the sort of producing beautiful flowers or making somewhere that's wonderful to be, I think it's the experience of doing inside this experience of time that is so beguiling.
A real touchstone, I think, for the book. I mean, it's one long chapter, but it also is a touchstone, is John Milton's famous poem, Paradise Lost. And of course, in the subtitle of your book is In Search of a Common Paradise. Talk about Milton's poem. It's about the expulsion, of course, from the Garden of Eden. Tell us what was so resonant to you as you worked on your garden in the midst of a pandemic. You read this long poem.
Well, first of all, the poem is supremely fantastic, and I came to it in my 40s without having realized how great it is. So if anyone's listening and hasn't had the joy of reading Paradise Lost, sit down and read it. But the best thing is to start reading it out loud, because it is so alive. It's like the first graphic novel. It's like the beginning of cinema. It's incredibly kinetic and exciting. So there was that. There was just the experience of it as language. But then there was also the story it tells and the story of its own emergence into the world. Milton wrote it at a time of despair. He wrote it as his side on the Civil War, as he began to realise that his side in the Civil War had definitively lost, that the royalist cause was actually the victors. And it comes out of this experience of fear, real jeopardy, real terror, danger. And it's actually written in this moment of plague as well. So it really felt like it had an awful lot in common with the feeling that I had during the pandemic, not only of being afraid of this illness that was racing around the globe, but also of the sense that the liberal project was failing, that democracy itself was sort of crumbling at its foundations, that very frightening feeling that things that had seemed permanent were no longer permanent, I think had an awful lot in common with Milton and Milton's take on the world. So the idea that in that moment, what he did was to dream of Eden, to try and describe and set out what an ideal state could be, that felt very exciting to me. I think we're in a time where we're obsessed with creating and conjuring dystopias, thinking of worse and worse futures. And to me, the idea of somebody trying to think of a utopia, of a better world, felt really productive, really stimulating, and really practically useful. So that was what I got out of reading Paradise Lost.
And if anything, I mean, certainly for us here in the United States, but I'm sure in the rest of the world as well, that sense of the liberal experiment crumbling is even more acute now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important to think of these, you know, perhaps old dreams of paradise that might still have all kinds of vitality and usefulness for us now. That was really one of the motivating forces for this book in terms of thinking about these dreams of utopia through the centuries, was to think, well, are any of these useful? Are there ideas in here that we really need now? The book is really structured to be a seed box full of ideas.
Yes, it really is. But first, you go through, let's say, the dark side of Eden. And it's very much the difference almost between the dark and the light. It centers around this idea of inclusion versus exclusion. You go back to the roots of the beginnings of the great manor house formal gardens that were based basically on exclusion. Talk about the Enclosure Act and how that transformed the landscape of your native land.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think sometimes people, including people who've grown up here, people who've lived in England all along, look at our landscape and think, oh, that's a natural landscape. That's exactly what it is like, these parklands, these beautiful trees, these lakes, how beautiful England is. And in fact, it's a completely artificial landscape, and it arose in the late 17th and 18th century. And it was a way of showing dominion over nature, a way of making a sort of better version of nature, nature like a landscape painting. And what that process involved was, as you say, the act of enclosure, which is the act of taking common land, land that belonged to everybody, land that was relied upon by the peasantry, and putting it into private hands. And either that land became part of these parks and these great estates, or it was turned into farmland, which then paid for these parks and great estates. So you see this dual process, I think, which is A, the seizure of the common land, and B, the creation of a new landscape that looks as if it is inevitable, natural, and permanent, none of which it actually is. So I really wanted to sort of expose that version of paradise and to think really carefully about what that version of paradise cost, and very much, who did it exclude?
Yes, and who did it exclude? I mean, there were the peasants. I mean, there was also, it reminded me so much of, I think, an ongoing enclosure that is happening all the time. More and more areas of life are falling out of the commons and into private hands. So communities, whole communities were wiped out.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways that became a very silent process, because there's a real dearth of voices speaking back. It's not that people didn't speak up at the time, but they're sort of silenced by not being in the written record. And so the person that I used here, the person whose voice I relied upon to give a sense of resistance, a sense of the consequences, was the poet John Clare, the so-called peasant poet, who loved the common land, who wrote very beautifully in praise of it, and then who wrote these great elegies of desperation and despair about enclosure, about the acts of enclosure, about the destruction of the loved landscape, and then who almost had a breakdown and spent the rest of his life in institutions. And there are many reasons for that, as there always are with people's mental ill health. But it's really clear from what he says that part of that is a sense of rupture with the landscape that he depends upon. And you really see him almost as this kind of early prophet of ecocide. He understands our existence as an ecological network in the same way that somebody like Robin Wall Kimmerer does. You know, it's really cutting edge thinking and at the same time ancient thinking. And he exhibits in his own person and his own life the kind of damage that I think we're just starting to understand now of what happens if you destroy people's ecosystems, what happens to them in their emotional lives, in their hearts, as well as in their practical and economic lives. So he seems to me such a prophetic and important figure.
Absolutely. I recently interviewed the author of a book about the impact of climate change on the brain. And, you know, what's so striking is this cleaving of our souls from nature is just so profoundly destabilizing to us, not only as a society, but really as individuals.
Absolutely. And it was so interesting when I finally came to read Braiding Sweetgrass to just think, this is John Clare. This is pure John Clare. It's all of the sort of knowledge that he had and all of the consequences that he foresaw are being acted out in our own century.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Olivia Lang about her book, The Garden Against Time, In Search of a Common Paradise. Before we go on to the common paradise, let's talk about one more example in the book of gardens, shrublands, where it's not just enclosure or exclusion of the people who used to be there, but then the actual capture and horrific exploitation of slavery. This was a garden very dependent on slavery. So tell us a story of the Middleton family.
Absolutely. So the Middletons were an English family who went to the West Indies and made a fortune in slave plantations and then moved to America and continued that work. They built rice plantations. They continued to make huge fortunes from very, very directly from slavery. They built the first landscape garden in America. And then some of the family came back to England and they built this extraordinarily lavish garden over a series of generations. And one of the things that I found interesting and troubling about it is that if you looked at it from the outside, you would have no idea that slavery was part of the story. So what I wanted to do was really forensically try and show how money that was arising out of slave plantations in America was being used to create this sort of beautification of the English landscape. And the purpose of it, absolutely, was for social leverage and an accumulation of social power. So by the end of the Middleton story, they were dining with Prince Albert. They had relationships with the royal family. They really had insinuated themselves into the highest echelons of society. And that process, I started thinking about it and I thought it's like the Sackler family. In the same way that the Sackler family used art to wash their money of its origins, to cleanse their reputations, the Middleton family used the production of this garden, the creation of this garden, as a way to whitewash their money, to make their money seem as if it was innocent and pure, when in fact it came from the most brutal and violent exploitation. So that seemed to me a real example of the sort of darkest ends to which gardens could be put, the least equitable paradise, I think, in the book.
Yes, and I think your descriptions of slavery are so vivid as well. You know, often when one reads references to slavery in books that are not specifically about slavery, You know, it's just, it goes unsaid in a way how, the details of the horror, because it's assumed that everybody knows them. But I think it's very important and useful to do what you did, which is to, you know, it doesn't saturate the narrative, but it's there. We are reminded of exactly what it meant to be a slave and to be treated in that way.
And I think that's so important, because I think otherwise in some way you're potentially contributing to that whitewashing and pretending that it's more innocent than it was.
Yes. And we have, politicians here who are in some ways running on the restoration, if not of slavery, the system that allowed it to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But then there is the garden as a common space, the garden as inclusion. And you write about the early English communists and socialists and people like William Morris, who established or tried to establish utopian communities, much like the ones that I knew well in the 1970s and that you were part of in the 1990s.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's this sort of fantastic thread that runs through our history, that there is this desire to make a different kind of community. And these communities have kept coming and they're going to keep coming. And I think there's a real, there's a real power in them, because they are founded on principles that are equitable, and that aren't just equitable between different humans, but between humans and other species. And that's the place we're going to have to go if we want to survive, I think.
Absolutely. And you write that we need more gardens in the world, and that they need to be part of what you call a cherished commonwealth. Earlier, you said you see this book as, kind of seeds of change. I don't think you said seeds of change, but the seeds was in there. Flesh out that vision for us a bit.
I think what I would really like to see is a massive extension in public gardens. And that's twofold, really. We know that for our cities to survive climate change, we are going to have more things that can deal with floods, things that can deal with high temperatures. And even more than planting trees, botanic gardens can do that. Botanic gardens can lower temperatures. Botanic gardens can act as spaces for storing water to ameliorate against flood damage. So they are this sort of extraordinary antidote to some of the ferocity of climate change. And at the same time as that mass expansion, I'd like to see a mass expansion in apprenticeships for young people becoming gardeners. Gardening as a practice is something that improves our physical health, it improves our mental health. The idea of that as a space for people to work in, and the idea that people can do that to create these communal spaces that are very beautiful, that act as habitat, that increase biodiversity, but also act as community places of respite, places of beauty. That seems to me the most useful direction for gardening to go in the 21st century.
I couldn't agree more. This book, The Garden Against Time, In Search of a Common Paradise, is such a wonderful accompaniment to those of us, and there are more of us every day who are on that very same project. Olivia Lang, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
What a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Lang is an internationally acclaimed writer and critic. They're the author of 7 books, including The Lonely City and Everybody. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.